This is The Conversation, a podcast that goes behind the scenes of the art world and sometimes academia. I'm Michael Shaw. It's 2019. Welcome to the show. It's episode 234 with Simon Leung. He is an artist, and he is the head of the MFA program at University of California, Irvine. When we spoke initially, Simon mentioned the word precarity, and that particularly pricked my ears, and I thought it would be interesting to talk about his friend, muse, and longtime collaborator, Warren Nishlikowski, who is the subject slash star of his film War After War, and take that as a starting point or an ending point, depending on which direction you're talking about, with Simon's very secure tenured professor position. And it also became a conversation about academia, getting teaching jobs, the realism or relative lack of realism of doing so, particularly in places like Los Angeles and so on. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where, of course, you can see images of Simon's work, including moments from the film, as well as from some of the performances we're talking about, including his actions and actions adjuncts performances, which, of course, relate to labor rights and whatnot, which we talk about as well. You can also find past episodes, especially via the episode index page. You can support the show, find our social media handles at Artist Podcast. You can find the link to iTunes where you can leave a nice review about the show. Please do so if you haven't already. Thank you very much. It's a pretty heady conversation, but not without a certain amount of motion and things that you, the listener, should be able to relate to. So I hope you enjoy it. And on the back end today, I don't know if you saw this, but in case you didn't, there was a report that came out just prior to the holidays about cities that people are moving to, the trend of moving to certain cities. The piece is called Which Cities Are People Leaving and Where Are They Going? So I'm going to refer to that, go down the list, and maybe some of you guys listening will identify with particular exoduses that are going on. And I'm also, I think, going to talk briefly about a conversation I had with my landlord, because that's related to housing. We actually talked about housing in the neighborhood, and here he is, my landlord. So that was pretty interesting, and I think you might find it interesting as well. All right, so let's get to that conversation with Simon. Please do stick around for the back end. It's good to talk to you again. I hope you're having a good year so far, and talk to you more on the back end. You are a tenured chair of the graduate program at UC Irvine.
Yes.
Correct?
That is what I am.
And if you think about artists and their gigs, their careers, you know, you could think about the ideal artist life as an artist who's consistently selling their work and they get to work on their art all the time. But if you think a little bit more, those types of artists are, for the most part, still vulnerable to market fluctuation and what have you. They're not fully secure the way that somebody who's a tenured professor is. And so what I'm getting at is, in talking about precarity, it seems like as an artist, you're about as far away from precarity as one can be.
I think that's true.
Yeah. And so meanwhile, you've made this film. Well, I guess was it officially produced, or you put the copyright on it in 2011, so several years ago now?
Mm-hmm.
Have you done anything with him since?
I have done things with him, but I think I should probably preface it by saying that it's actually one of three works, rather large works, that I've made with Warren.
Right.
And the first one was in 1992, 93.
Was that Warren Peace?
It's called War and Peace.
P-I-E-C-E?
P-I-E-C-E, yes.
Right.
It was called War and Peace in the 70s. And it originated as my project for the exhibition at PS1 when they used to have a residency program.
Right.
And I gave myself a rule of working with somebody who worked at PS1, who was an employee at PS1, and I being an artist in residence, I reasoned was kind of like being a shifter, the way that an employee is also a shifter. So if you think about the institution itself as a constant thing, the people who cycle through it as employees, as artists in residence, we can move, but we meet in the institution. So I began working with Warren because I wanted to make it work with somebody who worked there, and within 30 seconds of proposing it to him, I saw the entire piece.
Mm.
Because what he told me was that he was a deserter from the American Army during the Vietnam War. And my association with PS1 was probably similar to many people's in that I think of the 70s. And so I just thought, Warren's a deserter. He came back to America, obviously. And 1976 was biennial, you know, the American, not biennial, what do you call it? Bicentennial.
Art world but, slip.
I know. Freud lives.
Yeah.
So I kind of put the two together, and I made a work about Warren and about PS1 simultaneously. It was
right.
A double portrait of PS1 and Warren. And it was built around the idea of Warren being a deserter and how desertion during the time of a war, like the American Vietnam War, could be developed into the thinking of something ethical rather than something that is criminal. So, you know, I was really kind of thinking about how betrayal or the idea of betrayal does constitute a type of ethics. So that was in 1992-93, and it was right after the first Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
I began working with Warren again right after the war in Iraq, you know, soon after two.
Had you been, you know, just for to bring listeners up to speed a little bit, because the way I recall it being sort of described is that you've been filming him for 20 years. Were you continuing to take video of him in the meantime between those pieces that you were working
no,
with him?
No, well, I'd been working with him for over 20 years.
Okay.
Actually, by now, over 25 years.
Yeah.
No, it's sporadic.
Right.
You know, because we did this piece in 1992, 93, where we made three videos and a bunch of wall pieces. And then we were just, you know, friends. And then after 9/11, after the second war in the Middle East, you know, the beginning of the war on terror, right? The Bush
mm-hmm.
second war.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that Warren had lost his apartment. I know that he was no longer in
PS1.
He was no longer at PS1, and he was in a relationship that ended. So I just heard through friends that, you know, Warren's just been staying with other people. And so we met up again. And I think by then I was already teaching at Irvine, right? So I was living mostly in L.A. And I just said, you know, Warren, let's just make another work together. And he agreed. And so for the next 8-9 years or so, what I would do is I would just bring Warren out to L.A. Sometimes he stayed with me. Sometimes I would find him a place to live. Or I would go to Warsaw, where he was based a lot of the times, and I would work with him. Or go to London, where he would travel to every once in a while, or to New York. And we would mostly just talk about his life and what he was planning and how he was seeing everything. And, you know, we have the kind of relationship where we talk about a wide range of things, but mostly the topic is him.
Okay, so now that you've sort of given people a context for your relationship with him, I want to ask you some specific questions about his life that mm-hmm. partially have come up in the work, but probably many that have not. Mm-hmm. So you met him when you were working on a project at PS1. What was he doing at PS1? What was his job?
He was the assistant to the director.
Okay.
Alana Heiss.
Ah, got yeah. it. What is his background? I mean, is he... I know that you mentioned at some point that he studied theater. Does he have a history in theater?
He studied theater in the sense that he performed with Bread and Puppet and hung out with them. And also he studied with Grotowski. And this was a result of him having had deserted from the army and ending up in Paris. You know, he actually was in Paris in May 68.
Wow.
Right. And he was a very conventional person before then, you know, Polish, immigrant, Catholic. So he was drafted and then had...
And just sorry to interrupt, he was a refugee from the Nazi era, but he became an American citizen, and that's why he could be drafted, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, he was born actually right after the war.
Okay.
And his parents met in a displaced persons camp in Germany
mm-hmm.
because a lot of Polish people were put basically into work camps.
Mm-hmm.
And Warren spent the first 5 years of his life in a refugee camp, in a displaced persons
wow.
camp,
mm-hmm.
before his parents immigrated, and they immigrated to New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Mm.
Very sort of working class mm-hmm. Town.
Right. What at the time were Warren's aspirations? I mean, I'm not clear still if he was sort of on a performance artist tract, an actor tract, none of the above?
None of the above. No,
Did he not know?
He did not know. He still does not know. So he really compares himself to Horatio, you know, somebody who is not in the center of things, but somebody who facilitates. And I think he still has that notion about himself
mm-hmm.
that he is, he does not really self-identify as an artist.
But he does self-identify as a nomad. Or did that only come later?
He does self-identify as a nomad.
You met him. He had a full-time job, an apartment, et cetera, back in the early 90s when you were collaborating with him for the first time.
Yeah.
Cut to, at some point, 10 years later, he was essentially a nomad. He was homeless. Did he lose that PS1 job? Did he leave that job and have a success in other jobs?
No, that was the only job he ever had. That was the only consistent job he ever had. 3 years of a life that is now 72.
How did he lose it?
I don't completely know, but I think he just decided not to work anymore.
Wow, interesting. So this is bringing to mind, I feel like I should just disclose, since it's on my mind, not that it's necessarily a great analog, but there is this guy named Daniel Suello. A book was written about him called The Man Who Lived Without Money, or something very close to that. It's about this guy who basically stays in caves, stays with friends, family, etc., but basically does not use money. Everything he does for exchange and whatnot.
Mm.
And I wonder if there's a similar spirit, a similar ambition with Warren, in a sense. Maybe he was not as aware of it. But I see his situation, of course, as much more urban, much more urbane, much more cosmopolitan. And yet, in some ways, it kind of feels similar, like he's living on the hospitality of others to some extent.
Yeah, that's right. I think there were probably a lot more people like Warren in the 60s. And if you were to think of how he came from a rather conventional background and was, in a sense, thrown into May 68 and began living in communes in France,
mm.
everybody shared everything, especially in the theater world,
right.
In the experimental theater world.
Right.
And for about 6 or 7 years, it was not that unusual to lead the type of life that he led. It's just that most people eventually got jobs and professionalized themselves and started families, but Warren didn't. And in some ways, he's kind of the spirit of the 60s.
Right.
In a contemporary human form.
Mm.
And when I started the work with him, it was really thinking about desertion. But years later, when I started working with him again in the 21st century, it was really kind of about him returning to another war story, right? So if the deserter is one figure in war, the other figure that I think he occupies is that of the refugee.
Right.
Somebody who is in need of being welcomed. And in his case, it was almost as if he atavistically returned to becoming the refugee that he technically was for the first 5 years of his life. So, you know, I don't have a grand narrative about this, and I don't really have a grand theory about it. But I see how he exists in relationship to conventional, standard, normal, societal narratives.
Right.
And he falls out of that in a way, but he doesn't fall out of it if you think of it in relationship to war. You know, so in some ways, I think how Warren lives is really a story of asking us to place ourselves, you know, in precarious or more precarious situations. And, you know, these are times in which there are millions and millions and millions of displaced people, you know, all over the world. Now, Warren technically is no longer a refugee, but what he poses to his friends is always a type of ethical question. And it goes something to the effect of, how much will I give? Do I buy him a meal?
Mm.
Can he stay with me for a couple of nights? Can he stay with me for a month? You know, these are actually practical questions, right? And it puts you, in encountering Warren, into a question about, you know, what is hospitality in this particular scenario, at this particular moment?
You know, something that's occurring to me as you're talking about, and I know you don't totally maybe mean this, but it sounds like the way you're describing Warren now, it sounds like you're sort of seeing him through the eyes of this piece. But I wonder if for people listening, hearing you talk about it this way, if there isn't maybe potentially an exploitive element, you know?
Yeah, I think about that a lot.
Yeah.
And
what do you think about that now?
Well, I think of my work with Warren as a collaboration. He thinks of it as my work.
Right.
It's a very delicate thing.
Mm-hmm. But you have...
I'm sorry,
let me just say this real quick. You have got him residency. So you have at least contributed to his lifestyle. Right?
Yes, yes. Warren is, in a way, a public figure. It takes a lot of work to be Warren.
Right.
It takes a lot of work to hustle a place to live.
Yeah, and you say, by the way, this was in the Art Forum piece that kind of accompanies the video. I just wanted to quote it from it. You say, in a way, Warren asks us to think about what work is. It takes a lot of work to be Warren. It requires constant care and constant negotiations.
Yeah.
And just to be practical for a second, because we did talk about how it was a choice of his.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this interesting dichotomy or just way of looking at this that is, well, it's work for him, but it's his choice to work. You know, he chose not to sort of go anywhere near the straight route. So maybe for him, for you, and for me, sounds like a lot of work, all these negotiations constantly. Maybe for him, it's just a lifestyle.
I think of it this way. He has a choice and he doesn't have a choice. You know, we can think of the idea of a choice as, in a way, the effect of ideas about what it means to be a person, right? You know, you think you have individual choices as a person. You think you have free will. But, you know, as history shows and, you know, as we know just from looking around, you know, at people who have less of these kinds of ideologies embedded in their psyches, mm-hmm. The idea of choice is always bound up with very specific circumstances. You know, if you had a trust fund, you have a little bit more choice than if you have to work, right? So I think, yes, Warren has chosen to live this way, but I don't know what other way he can live. I really don't know, right? It's a complicated and almost impossible thing to really fully answer.
Right.
Because there's a certain thrownness, a certain, I guess, groundlessness with which he operates.
It seems like a real testament to him and his personality that he's been able to maintain this, being the beneficiary of this hospitality over the years like this. I mean, because...
Well, Warren also gives.
Mm, what does he give?
Well, he's good company for many people.
Okay, that speaks to my point.
Listens to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that works for a while. You know, it generally works until it doesn't work. And that's why he would, you know, need to find the next bed.
Well, in any case, I still think that even if he's, you know, staying with somebody for, you know, 4 days, and then it becomes clear that it's time to move on, I think being able to do that perpetually is pretty amazing. Because as much as people talk about the art world being, you know, a place, I mean, certainly many things are said about it, but sometimes people will characterize it as a place where people will help each other out. I don't know. Maybe that's a bygone sentiment. But I think that as in the best case scenario, being able to do that would only last for a finite amount of time.
Yeah.
With just about anybody.
But I also think the art world is one of the few places or one of the few types of societies that would accommodate somebody like Warren.
And I wonder if your piece, to what extent your piece has sort of branded him, you know, as sort of this nomadic performance artist, and therefore the people that are hosting him, you know, are getting in on that piece to some extent, or that process.
I don't know, but Warren always wants to show it to people.
Right.
He always asks me, oh, what is the link? You know, I want to show it to somebody. And, you know, we made a little book for it, and he's eager to share.
How do you think his life of precariousness informs your own, the way you think about your own? I mean, was that one of the benefits of work collaborating? Has that been one of the benefits of collaborating with him, that it gives you a certain kind of perspective on what you have?
Well, I don't think the work, for me, works as a lens or as a tool for my own life.
But just his life, apart from the collaboration then. Because you do see that too in the process.
I think we had certain things in common, right? We're both immigrants. We both immigrated to this country when we were children. And I think Warren and I share maybe a sense of what it means to have the advantage of growing up, you know, in a context where we don't just see the American dream realized, where ideas about individual choice and success and possibilities we see how that has limits.
And you kind of landed on a place where I was kind of going, and I want to see if we can flesh it out a bit more. And that is, do I understand that you, despite your being place of incredible security, at least, you know, on the surface, because of the roots that you have, because of where you come from, that you're not able to fully relax into that place, that there's a certain amount of skepticism
Well, I say this probably once a day. I just can't believe how lucky I am. And, you know, I didn't go to graduate school, so I wasn't counting on becoming a professor. It didn't happen accidentally, you know, but it happened despite the odds against
someone,
you know, like me becoming secure. In fact, you know, I think we were talking a little bit earlier about Hunter, and it's true. I tried to go to Hunter College twice for graduate school. The first time it was because it was right after the Whitney program, and I just couldn't believe. It's not that I couldn't believe. I just couldn't be in that type of intellectual environment after after the Whitney program.
Okay? Right, right. He's right.
And the second time was after, you know, okay, so I should back up a little bit. Charles Gaines came out to New York and offered me a job at CalArts in 1996. And I thought, wow, CalArts, this mythic place. I was living below the poverty line in New York, you know, as a young artist.
How are you supporting yourself?
Oh, I was teaching through the new museum.
You were you were an adjunct teacher who was making very little money.
I was making very little money.
Right. I wonder what that's like.
And then I had a full-time teaching gig at CalArts for 2 years. Now, I was supposed to come up for one semester, and I was ready to go back to New York, and Charles said, Al Ruppersberg cannot do the spring semester. Do you want it? And I said, yes, I want health insurance, I want dental care, I want a salary. And he said, well, you have to apply for it. Fine, I'll apply for it. I applied for it. And then Charles said, well, we're going to give it to you, but only on one condition. I thought, what could this possibly be? And he said, on the condition that you would stay for another year. So it was great. I'm very grateful to Charles and CalArts. Anyway, so I taught at CalArts for 2 years, and then I adjuncted at UCLA and Irvine, and then I went back to New York to teach at RISD and NYU. Now, when I was at UCLA, Mary Kelly, who was the chair at that time, told me, things would be so much easier for you if you have an MFA, if you want to teach. So I called up a couple of schools in New York City, Columbia and Hunter, namely, because I was already teaching at NYU, and I thought, oh, get a quick and dirty MFA. And the then dean or chair, whatever he was at Columbia, Ron Jones, you might have to erase this. so he basically said, yeah, we would love to have you, but, you know, you can't get a quick and dirty MFA. You know, there's no scholarship. Like, basically.
Oh, you have to pay for it.
I would have to pay for it. And then I called up Andrea Blum, who is still teaching at Hunter, I believe. And she said, don't go to graduate school. You know, you don't need it. You win the Whitney Biennial. We could have you teach, but we can't have you as a student. So I just thought I was going to adjunct at NYU or wherever. And I thought to myself, oh, what do I want to do? I can work in a frame store, maybe. I like working with my hands, but I don't want to get too dirty. You know, that was really how I was conceiving, you know, of moving as I, you know, as I'm now by then in my 30s and thinking a little bit more about, you know, living like a grown-up. And then three jobs opened up in California at UC San Diego, at USC, and at Irvine. I applied to all of them. I was shortlisted for all of them. I flew out for interviews at all three. And I didn't think my Irvine interview went well, but that was the last place I interviewed. And within 24 hours, Youngsun Min, who was the chair of the committee, called me and said, we want you to come. So that's how I became a professor. I was threatened by employment by the University of California, and I had no health insurance. I could not turn it down, you know. That's the story of how I became.
So you became a full-time professor for the second time?
For the first time.
What the one at CalArts?
I was a visiting person.
Oh, okay.
I was a full-time person, but I was a visiting person.
Right, okay. So the point that I'm making is that you became a full-time faculty at Irvine, not having an MFA.
That's right.
Is there a precedent for that since the 80s?
You know, I think there are a lot of people who teach without MFAs. In fact, there are quite a number of people who are teaching at UCLA right now who have been hired who don't have MFAs since the time that I was hired at Irvine.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the dirty little secret, right?
Are they all art stars of a sort?
Well, that's the secret.
Yes, that's the dirty little secret. Right.
Well, what I was going to say was actually something a little bit more specific,
okay,
which is the University of California does not care if you have an MFA.
Right.
But maybe a school that is not as prestigious or not as interested in research, if you're talking about, let's say, a school that's much more geared towards teaching rather than your own work, then I think you do need an MFA.
Right.
Harvard does not care if you have an MFA, if they want you to teach.
Okay.
You know? UCLA doesn't care. Mm-hmm. Irvine doesn't care.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. How do you feel? And I don't want to make this a big side conversation, but just kind of a very brief question about, I mean, certainly you are going to have a particular attitude towards your students, you know, and your mm-hmm. prospective students.
Sure.
But if you were in a, let's just say, a party conversation with a promising undergrad and they asked you, should I get a master's, what would you say to them?
Well, I think very few people should actually go to graduate school.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In art.
What should they do during the time that they would be going to get an MFA instead?
Well, I think for most undergrads, what they should probably do is to graduate and keep working and take a few years before they apply to graduate school. You know, if you're 23, if you're, you know, 22, 23, students tend to be a little bit older now, but whatever. And you're in an undergraduate art program and you are praised for your work and you feel like this is something you can really do. And then you apply to graduate school. Well, you might get in, you might not get in. But my take is that oftentimes, if you're very young and you go to graduate school, you're not making the best use of it. Some people go to graduate school too soon.
Hello, right here, raising his hand.
It means to me that graduate school becomes the only point of reference for you as an artist. Right? School becomes the only reference for you as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's the best thing. Because oftentimes when you're in your early 20s, mid-20s, you don't really have that much to say. So I come from a moment in the 80s when nobody thought they were going to make a living from being an artist, right? And you only go to graduate school if you really, really, really feel like this is what you want to do. I think there are certain paradigm shifts within art education, which basically turned education into a commodity, turned the MFA into a type of, you know, product.
And you went to Columbia, which was like kind of the apex of that kind of scenario, right?
You know, but I have to say, when I went to Columbia, I just wanted to live in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I transferred as an undergraduate from UCLA to Columbia. And I had no idea what kind of school it was. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't one of the, you know, star programs.
It was before that, yeah.
It was way before that.
Way before that.
You know, I think Yale was really the school. I don't really know. I wanted to live in New York because I was reading The Anti-Aesthetic. Do you remember that book?
Of course.
Okay.
I think a lot of your work addresses some of that book quite well.
Well, you know, right? this is the thing. You know, I was an undergraduate at UCLA, and the only reason I ended up at UCLA was because I wanted to go to a school far away from home, and Berkeley was too close, and plus my brother was going to Berkeley. I didn't want to be at a school where my brother was, and I wanted to be in a big city, so that was LA. You know, I didn't, nowadays kids, you know, they go to college tours and, you know, they spend, you know, I don't know, thousands of dollars trying to figure out where they want to go. I had none of that, you know. I was an immigrant kid, right? And then I just really, really wanted to live in New York because I come from Hong Kong and I was used to a big city and I always felt a little bit displaced in California anyway. And I was reading about postmodernism in Howard Singerman's class. Howard Singerman, who's now the chair of the Art and Art History program at Hunter College.
Hmm.
And I thought, I should probably just go where the action is intellectually. So that's how I ended up at Columbia. And almost as soon as I arrived in New York, I thought, I should go back to UCLA. Not because I didn't love New York and not because I didn't think Columbia was a good school. You know, it's an amazing school. But I just couldn't afford to put myself through Columbia. And I'm Chinese. I cannot be in debt, you know. And UCLA was paying me to go to school where, and I think I wrote a check for $10,000 or something like that, which is cheap, you know, by today's standards,
right,
for a semester at Columbia. And I had never had any contact with that large a sum in my life before, right? And I thought about how, you know, at UCLA, Mike Kelly was my professor, and I could be wearing shorts if I were in LA right now. There are all kinds of reasons where I thought UCLA was just as good a school as Columbia. And lo and behold, you know, 30 years later, these are the hot art schools. But, you know, none of this was planned.
Sure. Well, I want to go back to, again, the sort of premise or conceit of my angle of the conversation. And I feel like we could dig there forever, but that is, you did say that just about every day you are thankful for how lucky you are.
I am.
But is there a certain amount of unease about your place, about your being a tenured professor?
I don't know if there's a sense of unease, but I do think about being in the world with other people who have a lot less.
And that's what I'm interested in hearing about too.
And I think about it mostly in relationship to, in my personal experience, with other artists and with the students. We live in a time of precarity. We live in a time where most people don't have security and most people cannot do any better than they are. So I think a professorship at the University of California is really kind of a relic of another idea of society. You know, what is called the master plan for the University of California. when in, I believe, 1960, there was the idea that because the state is growing exponentially, and this was during a wealthy time in this country, that the state of California would invest in its people, right? And that's why I was able to go to UCLA for free. They paid me to go to UCLA as an undergraduate. You know, those days are gone, and I just feel very, very lucky that I went to school, you know, in the 1980s. When I started at Irvine in 2001, I think, I can't really be sure, but I think the tuition was maybe a third of what it is now. Right? So it's become more and more and more unaffordable. Yeah, so that's how most people are. So I'm a, you know, I am a state employee. I'm a public servant.
Right, right.
So this is what I think about in relationship to the insecurity of others, that, you know, it's really my job to help take care of some people. You know?
Do you feel envy, competition, you know, anything from other people who are in more states of precarity? You know, do you, whether you feel it directly or maybe you just kind of imagine it, you know what I mean?
Well, what do you mean?
In other words, you mentioned how in other people, you, other artists, you sense, you know, you're aware of that precariousness.
Oh, yeah.
In life.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm wondering, like, for a given artist, say, whether it's one of your graduate students or an artist that you maybe as an acquaintance, you know, in the LA community or what have you, if there's somehow either on an explicit or implicit level, Simon, how is it that you get to have this security and I have what I have?
Yeah. Well, if, yes, I do sense that from some people. I try not to pay that much attention to it because it's not really directed at me, right? I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of people who get MFAs in the greater LA area every year.
Mm-hmm.
There may be one job a year, you know, so chances are if you're looking to become a professor at a university, especially one that's high profile, one that's a research university, let's say, or at CalArts, someplace like that, chances aren't really that great. I think white men especially have a sense of how someone like me might have taken away their chances.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
is that an implicit
understand.
Or explicit thing that you're describing?
I don't know how many times I've heard white guys say to me that it's a bad time to be a white man.
Well, I'm not going to say that. I'll let them say it for me.
I think it's so strange, the perspective, because of course I think it's true, you know, that most people feel, well, not most people, I think it's true that things are really rough, you know, if you want to get a job, if you want to get a secure job. The reason it's rough may not have that much to do with any person individually.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I also talk to people who say, well, I just want to be a working artist. Someone I'm thinking about specifically, you know, used to say to me, well, I don't want to be a star. I don't care about being a star. I just want to be a working artist. Because when I was growing up in New York City, I knew artists who were making a living, you know, as a working artist. But, you know, he grew up in the 70s. And it was much easier to live in New York in the 70s. There were factory jobs in New York in the 70s, right? So the way we think about who we are in relationship to other people in the art world, whether it's about getting a job as a professor or having gallery representation, I think we imagine it to be related to who you are and who other people are. I tend to think about it in terms of a structural dynamic where certain conditions of what is valued, you know, under this moment in capitalism produces the kinds of institutions, the kinds of schools, the kinds of markets that we live with. Almost no artist I know likes art fairs, right? But can galleries even survive without this type of, you know, compromise? Mm. Well, maybe it's not a compromise for some galleries.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I mentioned this to you when we talked on the phone. I had a conversation with my brother recently, and I was trying to impress upon him that, well, you know, there are all these different ways in which you can think about the economy. And he said to me, but you're the 1%. You know, he's basically saying to me what you just, you know, asked. You are the 1%. And I agree with him, you know, in terms of a certain level of, you know, of security in this economy, that I get to have unalienated labor, that I am continually stimulated by teaching, that it relates to my own work, that I have health insurance and a pension, you know. It's, my metaphor is that I'm like a Roman senator. You know, that's what a UC professor is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, somebody who can just move through the crowd.
Right.
And feel their sense of security relative to others.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a very, very rare thing.
Yeah.
I don't know how I got here, but I got here, and people who want to enter academia, I wish everyone could have this sense of security, and everyone should have a sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
But it's becoming rarer and rarer. And even somebody who is hired, let's say in the last year or so, they will not get the same package at UC that I got.
Mm-hmm.
I think it ended maybe about 3 years ago.
Mm.
You know, the pension plan would be a little bit different. I don't know how it works exactly. But, you know, as a young artist, I think I just made a certain decision about how I wanted to work and the way that I developed my work predisposed me towards teaching. Because if you start writing and if you have a certain facility, let's say with language or with theory, if you are legitimated by certain discourses, and if you partake in it, what that means is that, let's say, after working for 10 years, you become an expert in what you do.
Mm.
And, you know, this circles back to how to get a job without an MFA. If you're the expert at what you do, and they can only get you, or if there are, let's say, 10 people in the country who do what you do, and you're one of them, well, your chances of having a teaching job is that much greater.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I'm somewhat singular in what I do.
Is there a specific emphasis that we could describe as your expertise, or is it more generally contemporary art theory, etc.?
Well, my official expertise is, as conferred by the University of California, Irvine, is new genre, because that's the area that I
And that's head. What you've been working in with your own work since pretty much the beginning, right?
Yeah, I think I made more objects when I was, when I was a young artist.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started becoming more interested in doing what we called then project work, right? Work that required a lot of research, that required a love of engagement that's not really about develop something in the studio, something that might take years to make. For example, War After War took about 8 years, and the Workers' Theater piece, it took 13 years. I worked on something for 13 years, before I was able to present it. Yeah, so I always wanted to make an opera, so I did that. I treat my work as a site where I could do things to challenge myself.
Mm.
And if I haven't done something, before Actions, the piece that I did, The Kitchen, and then at The Hammer, I wasn't that interested in theater, But I saw a genre and a medium as being the right way to do something. And then once I get that in my head, I want to see that to completion.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there is crossover with what you do in the institution and economic change, being an activist for labor and that kind of thing? Because I know labor is something that, you've integrated into your work.
Yeah.
Do you feel like in retrospect, if not in the present, that there is, it's hard to really bring that out into the world? Or by doing it, are you, by just making these pieces, are you actually in some abstract way bringing these concerns out into the world?
You mean with Actions, or do you mean?
If you're doing work, your work and or working with students having to do with things about labor and, and what have you, labor issues, are these things ultimately trapped within, the context of the institution and or art? Or do they somehow migrate or flow over into the real world, if you will?
Well, first of all, I think the art world is the real world.
I've heard that sentiment before.
Yes. And maybe I should just go back to how I conceived of Actions.
Okay.
Because I think it's really quite relevant. Now, yes, I have a certain level of security now, but I actually didn't when
back
I conceived
in the day. Right.
of Actions. As I reflect on it, between 1989, which was the end of any formal schooling I had, after the Whitney program, and 2001, I had no real job security. I was an adjunct, or different varieties of adjunct, for about 11 or 12 years before I became a professor, right? So when I conceived of Actions, it was because in the year 2000, Yvonne Rainer and I wanted to go and support the workers who were on strike at MoMA. So we went there.
And they were striking for better wages and security?
They were striking for the right to negotiate and for benefits because their contract had run out.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the part of the museum that's basically the white collar section, right?
Oh.
So it's called the union is called PASTA. And it basically consisted of everybody from visitor services to people who worked in the bookstore to archivists, librarians, and people who are on the lower end of middle to lower end of the curatorial departments.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were, I believe, an associate curator down, meaning if you were an exhibition coordinator, assistant curator, up to associate curator, you can belong in the union. Anyway, so when I was there with Yvonne, I remember we were standing across the street from the entrance, and we saw people we knew walking in. The occasion was something called Party in the Garden. I think it's their big dinner that they would have every year.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw, you know, curators or artists basically crossing the picket line. And I was a little surprised, but not completely. You know, I remember seeing somebody who was then working at the Whitney Museum, who's a curator, walk into the museum. And I thought, well, you know, I understand, you know, why they would do that. But what struck me was that on the right side of the street was basically where the protest island was, you know, people with signs, people walking. But directly in front of the entrance, there was only one person who was part of the union, and it was a young woman in an evening dress, and she was handing out flyers to people walking in. And immediately I thought, I should do something, right? Because it read to me as a form of action that's an amalgamation of something that is aesthetic and something that is political. So it's not unlike what we in ACT UP used to call, let's do an action at City Hall. You know, you go and have a kiss-in, or you go and do something in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral. You know, that's somewhat theatrical, but it's a protest. And I was also thinking about art actions that have taken place at places like MoMA or the Met. So I'm thinking about the Art Workers Coalition or the Guerrilla Art Action Group. Anyway, this was during a time when I didn't have any job security. I was an adjunct teacher at NYU. And I just thought, the people who are striking, they're very similar to not only who I am, but all the people that I think of coming to New York, you know, as young people who wanted to work in opera, who wanted to work in the art world, who were artists, who were performers, who were writers. Why did they come to New York? They want to be with their people. But life was almost impossible being in New York. And I just felt a sense of people being together. And I felt I wanted to make something. And I just kind of saw the whole piece, you know, in a flash, that this could be workers' theater. Now, workers' theater, as how I understood it at that point, was really people who were workers, be they, you know, workers in a factory or, you know, people, let's say, farmers, you know, doing some kind of theatrical production which reflected on their own lives. When I began to develop the work, what really became the core of the research and development was talking to people who were on strike. And 13 years later, when I finally presented at the Kitchen, what I realized then was that, similar to how I made War After War for Warren, I was making a work for people who worked at MoMA, who were on strike. Because through the interview process, through them telling one another about it, many people met 10 years or 13 years, whatever it was, after the time that they were in the museum together. I worked with people who were actually on strike, and some of them were in the theater piece. I think Corinna Evangelista, she played Mary Corliss. She was a curatorial associate, so she played somebody who was a key figure in the strike, who was a curator. I had Burns Magruder, who was working in, I think, the publications department. He was the narrator. And I had Marina Urbach, who was working in visitor services, play herself, you know? But we were doing it for each other. So in some ways, I don't really think it's confined by the art world as such. At one performance, we did two performances in New York. At one performance, there were lots of people who were part of the strike. There was the president of the union. There was somebody who was the head of the Media and Performance Curatorial Program, department, I should say, from MoMA at the same place, right? And there were some art historians. So I felt like the work was basically a place where these different kinds of interests converged. Mm. So maybe there was one institution, maybe there were many different kinds of institutions, but they intersected at the work. Mm-hmm. And for the people who were working at MoMA, many people, by the way, agreed to talk to me, but they wouldn't be in the piece, or they would talk to me only anonymously. Maybe it was because they started off as labor, but then they ended up in management, right? Because as you rise through the ranks, you could no longer be part of the union. So that's what really happens, I think, in a work of art.
Right. What kind of takeaways did you get from having conversations with the people maybe who didn't end up in the piece, or just overall even?
Oh, quite a few of them came.
Okay.
And, you know, it was a very important moment in their lives. You know, Mary Corliss, for example, she had worked in the Film Stills Archive at MoMA for maybe over 20 years. And MoMA fired her. Mm. Well, I should say MoMA eliminated the department as it was. It was so brutal. I cannot overemphasize how this woman devoted her life to making things possible for scholars everywhere in the world. Mm. And she paid very, very dearly. Mm-hmm. You know, she lost her job, but the museum also changed because of this event. So for someone like her, you know, she was extremely complimentary. It was a meaningful event, I think, for her and for other people who were part of the strike but didn't participate directly.
Was there an upside to the strike ultimately?
Oh, they got what they wanted.
What happened to Mary?
Well, Mary's case went before a review board, and they ruled on the side of the museum. But she lost her life's work.
Did she get a severance?
I don't know all the details of it.
Okay.
But
she got contextualized as one of the heroes of this story, so I thought I would follow up. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, I don't know the exact amount, but after maybe 20 years, maybe 25 years, her salary never went above $50,000. Mm. As a full-time employee. In the year 2000, it was possible to work full-time at the Museum of Modern Art, living in New York City, and make $17,000 a year. You know, this is obscene.
I wonder if that is exemplary of a kind of cost trimming that is just, you know, kind of the way that the government tries to trim the arts and things like that, which have tiny, tiny budgets, relatively speaking. You know, that MoMA was kind of doing that same thing. They were just trimming these tiny, tiny budgets to appease board members or something like that.
You know, I also interviewed people who represented the museum legally. I cannot reveal their names, obviously. Mm. But some of the people who were on the side of the museum in this dispute said to me many years afterwards, I don't know what we were thinking. Mm. I don't know what we were really asking. Mm. Because the Museum of Modern Art is a very, very rich institution.
That's what I'm thinking.
You know, they're you know, multimillionaires, billionaires on the board.
Sure.
I think this was a moment when the museum was trying to test its limits. Mm. And it was a very good time to do that because it was the new decade, the new millennium. They were moving to Queens temporarily while the museum was being renovated. So certain people could be eliminated. And I think it really shows how an institution is never one thing, because the board of trustees, they may represent themselves as the institution, but there are also other people in the institution who maybe do most of the work, or who are, in a sense, the content,
mm-hmm.
who have different interests. So in order for someone to work at the Museum of Modern Art in the year 2000 and make $17,000 a year, what you're basically seeing is somebody who wants to be a part of something that they identify with. And maybe they would put up with very, very low salary, something that could not even adequately pay for rent, let's say, for some people, because they have a strong sense of identification, you know, with the institution, with art. Maybe they love being there, whatever. Maybe they love being in New York. I don't know, you know, what it might be for any individual person, but I think people felt something at stake in working at MoMA. It's just that what they feel on the level of identification is not commensurate with what they need to survive.
Right. And when you fill in, when you create a picture or a story like that, featuring these, you know, the Davids and the Goliaths or whatever analogy you want to use, I think this colorizes how the art world can indeed be the real world.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I did the piece at The Hammer, Connie Butler asked me to, you know, to do something. And I said, well, I would do actions, but I want to do a new work as well, because I'd been thinking about adjunct teaching. So in LA at The Hammer, it was called Actions Adjuncts. And I was thinking about the specific people that I know, former students or friends, fellow artists, who were living this life of adjuncting, or who wanted to become an adjunct even. My only rule was that in order for me to work with somebody, they have to have been involved in the educational complex, the art educational complex, in some way.
Was it cathartic for them as well to take part in that piece?
I think a few people whose lives did not improve much since then have said to me since being in the piece that it meant something.
Right. So finally, let's go back to finish up with Warren. How is he doing presently, as far as you know? And what is he doing?
Well, I saw him last week in New York.
Oh, okay.
We had dinner. I worry about him. I talked to someone else who took care of him. Took care of him in the sense that, you know, she also lets him stay at her place every once in a while. That I was worried, you know, and she agreed. So, yeah, a few of us are sort of keeping an eye on things.
Is his health?
I don't think his health is that great, no. No, he has a heart condition. And, you know, it's harder and harder to become a nomad as you enter your 70s. And he's right now 72.
Yeah. Yeah, as much as that's his destiny to be a nomad, at a certain point, it's just going to take a much heavier toll on the body than not.
I don't know if it's his destiny, but it is his condition.
Okay, that could be a whole nother episode, but yeah. Simon, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Michael.
And
it's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, and we're out. Thank you very much again to Simon for talking to me. I should have maybe acknowledged that not only were we talking in the same room, but of course we were talking, it was a local fellow artist on the show. First time in a while for that. Wonder when that's going to happen again. But in any case, thanks again to Simon. And do let us know what you've thought of this episode or any other for that matter via theconversationpod.com. Before we get to the which cities are people leaving and where are they going report that I want to bring you up to speed on, I do want to remind you, first I want to give a big, big thanks to Andy Davis, who was really, really helpful in shaping this particular episode. It was almost going to be split into two, but he helped navigate it into one. Also, thank you to Megan Bickle for her assistance on the show. And also want to take a moment, as we often do, to let you know that this is a listener-supported show. If you are enjoying what you're hearing, your financial support would be incredibly appreciated. You can donate one of a few different ways, and it really does help keep this show going into 2019 further. You can donate via PayPal, via Venmo, or via Patreon, or good old-fashioned check, and you can see those links all through the support page of the website, and I kindly ask that if you do donate via PayPal, if you can donate as a friend or family member, which they give you that option to do, then we don't lose the cut that goes to PayPal. Otherwise, you know, whatever's easiest for you, PayPal is great, Venmo is great, check is great, and you can do Patreon, where you support this show on an ongoing basis, at least as long as you're signed up, and you can do it for as little as $1 a month. And I'll just remind you finally that if you donate $30 or more to the show, I will get you all 7 of the bonus episodes. I can get you a bumper sticker, which features either the podcast logo and or the P word bumper sticker. So those are available. And yeah, thank you very much. And if there's anything else you want that I can provide, do let me know. And of course, you can also follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter, and you can leave a nice review on iTunes or whatever platform you use, which will help more people find this show. Thank you very much in advance. All right, so this is the piece that I was referring to. It is called Which Cities Are People Leaving and Where Are They Going? It's from the New York Times real estate section from December 20th, but the data comes from the real estate company Redfin. And I will just note from the intro, probably the most relevant thing to add before we jump in is the report says, the general trend was away from pricier East and West Coast markets and toward more affordable inland areas. Surprise, surprise. The top 10 most searched destinations had an average home price of $150,000 less than the top 10 areas people were contemplating leaving. Now let's get to what those cities are. Now, I'll just preface this briefly by saying, of course, I was concerned that one of the cities that people would be going to is Los Angeles. But in fact, that is not the case in this like top 10 list. So I was kind of relieved of that. Of course, people are leaving Los Angeles. I'll get to that in a second. We'll start with San Francisco, a very unsurprising locale for people to be leaving because of its immense cost of living. Top destination that people are going from San Francisco, Sacramento. I particularly wanted to mention all of this because we just had 2 Sacramento guests in the episode of Art Advice the last was with Kristen Herring, the second to last episode with Ayana Frisbee and Gioia Fonda. So they are both refugees from the Bay Area, and they are in Sacramento, as this report goes. So New York, now I was worried that New York outflow was going to be to Los Angeles, but surprisingly, it's to Boston, which is not an inexpensive city as far as I know. The outflow from Los Angeles is to Las Vegas. That is, I should say, the top destination is Vegas from Los Angeles. From Washington, D.C., the top destination is Philadelphia. From Denver, the top destination is Seattle. That's a little bit surprising. From Chicago, oh, no, I was wrong. The top destination is Los Angeles. So apparently, we are getting more Chicago residents coming here of late, although the ones that I've been familiar with are from the Bay Area. So if you're from Chicago and you're in LA recently, do let me know. I would really like to hear from you and hear about your journey west. The Spokane, Washington, top destination is Seattle. People are flowing from Spokane to Seattle, which is pretty counterintuitive considering you would think that Spokane has a much lower cost of living than Seattle. People from Milwaukee's biggest destination is Chicago. People from Houston's biggest destination is Austin. That also seems a little counterintuitive. I would think Austin would be more expensive to live in. And people from, finally, this is the last one, from the where people are leaving, Orlando, Florida, they're going to Miami. Once again, counterintuitive. I would think that Miami would be quite a bit more expensive than Orlando. All right, so let's go now to the greatest inflow. So people are most likely to be going to Sacramento, and that origin is from San Francisco, not surprisingly, as the other one alluded to. People are leaving New York, or I should say people are going into Atlanta, and the greatest inflow is from New York. People are going to Phoenix. The greatest inflow is coming from Los Angeles. So Angelenos who have moved to Phoenix, get in touch. Portland, Oregon, biggest inflow is coming from San Francisco. So in fact, the Portlandians who are, that I at one point thought were pissed off for all the Angelenos coming there, you actually have more San Franciscans to be pissed at than Angelenos. San Diego is being populated by people fleeing Los Angeles, which certainly makes sense geographically, but San Diego is not a cheap city. Maybe if you go into the cheaper areas of San Diego, you know, it's cheaper than LA. Miami, the biggest inflow is Orlando, so you again have that reverse equation. Austin is a big inflow, and the biggest origin is San Francisco. So that's Portland, Sacramento, and Austin are being flooded by San Franciscans. Tampa, Florida is being flooded by Miamians. Dallas is being flooded by Angelenos, people from Los Angeles. If you are in Dallas and you have recently arrived from Los Angeles, I would love to hear from you. And finally, Nashville is being inflooded by people from New York. So that's not too surprising. That sort of makes sense. So if you fall into any of those categories, or if you just have an opinion about inflow and outflow, I would love to hear from you. Do drop a line. And finally, for this episode, so I was my landlord... let me just set this up for you real briefly. My original landlord is a Russian gentleman who is, I believe, 93 or 94 years old now. And he came to Los Angeles after the war settled. His son, who is the guy that actually came over, who is more kind of taking over for his father in terms of, you know, upkeep and whatnot. And he is our point man for anything that comes up. So there was an issue with the stove, the oven the other day that he came over to deal with. And after he fixed it, we got into a little conversation about real estate because I asked him in particular about the house next door, which as you may have heard me talk about or seen me post on Instagram is being worked on. And the workers were taking down the fence that abuts our front yard. And I wanted him to let him know that that was going on and if he was okay with that, which he was. He said, you know, the owner contacted me a couple months ago and asked me if I wanted to go in on a new fence with him. And I said, this being the landlord said, I was perfectly happy with the way the fence is. So they're taking down this fence to put up another one and we're in the front yard doing so. Subsequently, we started talking about this house, this big box house, which is, I told him, prototypical for the neighborhood. And where are all these people coming from? They're coming from most likely, quote unquote, Silicon Beach, which basically means they're working for Google or a similar, maybe in some cases, YouTube, one of these types of organizations, often Google. These are the only type of people who can afford these $2+ million homes that are going up all over the place in our neighborhood. Now, here's the kicker to all of this. Thanks for bearing with me. It occurred to me after I spoke to him that here I am having kind of a semi-casual conversation with my landlord about, you know, all of this real estate that's going on crazily throughout our neighborhood. And he is in a prime position to sell this place and become, you know, another one of those players. I was not concerned. It didn't occur to me throughout the entire conversation that we had that that was, you know, part of the context of our conversation. He just seems so unthreatening, surprisingly, in regard to selling the place. I mean, when his father passes, whenever that is, he could very well do that. But it seems like he's pretty content. Knock wood. He's pretty content to maintain the place, the triplex that I am part of, and have the rent, you know, be his supplemental income. I don't even know what he does, by the way. He doesn't even know what I do. What do I do, by the way? So I like that. Don't you like that? Don't you like being at a party and being able to talk with somebody or a restaurant or whatever, and it never comes up what you do? Isn't that refreshing? So here, my landlord and I have not had this conversation about what we do, and he has the power to pull the rug out from under me at any time. So God willing, he will not do so. All right, that's enough God willings for this episode. Do let us know what you think of the show, this episode or any other. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you in advance for your support, and I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.